Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight we have another, I think, going to be a great show, dealing with metaphysics and spirituality and some elements of science and a bunch of other things that I think are relevant. And I thought tonight would be a good thing, a good time to talk about our soul's plans for our next life. Now, I've kind of dealt with the subjects, like a lot of other subjects, in various ways, but not as I'm going to talk about it tonight. So again, you're going to get a little different bent on things. And in addition, I also think it's relevant because a lot of people that I meet, at least, say, well, what was my last life like, and what is my next life going to be like? And they have a lot of questions that they don't really know very many answers to. And I think it's relevant because we are actually making what our next life is going to be like, in the physical world at least, our next physical world life is going to be like while we're doing this life. So it's kind of like you can change what things are going to be like, if you understand what I'm going to be talking about tonight. So that's kind of a very practical side of what I'm hoping to cover. And for those of you who are familiar with the current event situation, it's also relevant because we've had so many people lose their lives in the last 24 hours with the terrible earthquake and tsunami in Japan. And now it looks like part of Japan may be underwater because it subsided, meaning that part of it just sort of sank below the ocean level, similar to what happened, as I described it, in Atlantis. But a lot of people said, well, that's not possible. But maybe they want to take a look at this event right now and see. But, it's, in some cases, it could be 30, 40 feet or more, maybe even more. In this one earthquake, some areas of Japan may have actually fallen below sea level. And it's not a small, like, area. It's not a few acres or something. This is maybe thousands of square miles. So let's hope that maybe it'll come back up. You never know. Something will happen. Or maybe their present predictions or estimates of what is taking place, because nobody's really physically there, will change when they get closer to the scene and determine what's really going on. Right now, it's all based more on aerial observations. You know, it's hard to say how things are really happening. But anyway, so some people unfortunately lost their lives, and they did so within seconds to a minute or two, and it's a terrible thing, of course. And you don't have time to change your life plan if you're in that kind of situation. But you do if you're going to be living for the next few decades or whatever, and you're concerned, or years or whatever, and you're concerned about what your next physical life will be. Now, your astral life is another story. We can talk a little about that too, but the next physical life is where a lot of people seem to be focused on because they're physically alive right now, and they want to know what it's going to be like when they're physically alive 100 years or 150 years, it could be that much, for now, because that's about how long in the range that many people take before they reincarnate. And let's begin with the concept of the soul's plans, because that's what I'm talking about. Now, this could have been souls individual, it could have been souls plural, because souls don't work alone. But I thought it would be good to use the individual possessive in terms of plans, because the plans are intermingled by the very fact that there are multiple plans, but it is an individual soul that we have. We don't have a group soul. Even though our souls work with other souls and they create scenarios that are very important, it's still the individual soul's plan for us that really matters. And it's up to that soul to ultimately determine what our next physical life will be like. But that doesn't mean that we aren't part of that, because we become joined with our soul, both in consciousness and awareness, and that happens after our lower mental life is over. And at that point, you could say we and the soul are one, and that would be a correct statement. So we are going to be doing this, but in a soul state of mind, and not as we are in our present state of limited consciousness, mostly limited by illusion, caused by our senses or awareness being so limited by physical plane energies, which are very dense and not very responsive to just about anything. And they cause a lot of, we'll say, unfactual and incorrect information to be gathered. And then our personalities uses incorrect thought to make knowledge out of it. So by the time we're done, we're being filtered by filters by filters, and everything is being converted into more maybe what we want it to be, or sometimes what we are afraid of actually hearing and so and knowing about, so we're making it something we're comfortable with. So it is, I think, the best way to describe it, it is this that is preventing us from doing what I'm suggesting that we could do, and maybe we can get around. And by the end of tonight's show, hopefully we will. So what do I mean by soul plans? Well, our soul's plans, which will become ours eventually, are the plans to increase the growth of our, its creator, God, and to increase godliness in all ways and in all life forms, and to be of assistance to life in general in co-creating with God, especially to life that can do so intelligently, which is human beings and higher. So this is what the soul is really concerned about. And it's looking into our next life, even as we are going through this one, because it is trying to determine on a continual basis how we can best do this with the abilities we've shown, the new ways we're growing, the ways we're failing, and all of the ways that we presently are interacting with others about those same issues. So all of this is going together. Also, another factor, our past karma and how we're creating karma in the future. Karma is just unfinished causes. We've created things, but they haven't completed in their outcome. And so those outcomes may not be around again until our next physical life. The reason they don't come about in our astral or mental world lives is because the energy that produces the outcome, because this is an energy outcome we're talking about when we talk about cause and effect, isn't available. Only the astral energy and mental energies are available after we leave the physical world. And so there's physical world karma that cannot happen to us in our astral or mental lives. This is important to realize, because a lot of people say, well, why isn't that just finish it off in the astral or the mental world? And the reason is the energy. If you don't have physical energy, you can't deal with a lot of the causes. Some have some content of astral energy, emotional energy, and some lower mental energy involved in them, and therefore they can be dealt with to some extent in the astral and mental world, provided those things are not so intertwined and interconnected with physical energy. Sometimes they are so interconnected with the physical world that the chances of coming into their becoming relevant in astral or mental world life is almost zero. So even though theoretically we still may have feelings about the subject because the physical energy isn't around, it's not a big chance that we're going to actually have something that will be an effect from a physical world cause, be it before this lifetime or one that happened while we were physically in life. So that's just the way it is, and then we'll just wait. Now, sometimes, and this is important, this is another part of the defining issue about a soul's plans, sometimes those plans have to ignore some of the karma because it will be overwhelming and destructive to a person, and it won't lead to any benefit to anyone. Sometimes it will destroy the person but benefit those around them, and so the soul says, well, that's not such a bad idea. I mean, if that's the best a person can do, then that's okay with the soul. But a lot of times there's excessive amounts of karma from a particular number of physical world lifetimes. That is just too extreme. And so only a part of it will be dealt with. And sometimes it's based upon not the soul's plan, but the soul's understanding of when that karma is likely going to hit. This is complicated. The soul is so much more conscious than we are that it actually has some understanding, not a tremendous amount, not as much as a really advanced soul might, but most souls have some idea about when certain karma is going to hit. The more advanced a soul is, the better it is at doing this, and that's why they confer with other souls that are more advanced than themselves, and they also work together. And even then, they don't always come up with the right answers because they just don't know all the things about where karma is going to and how it's going to be interacted with. Karma changes, not just based upon what an individual is doing, but also what groups and countries in the world is doing. And so it can have an effect on what we think as individual karma, being outside of and greater than the individual. So this is a real tricky subject, and it's often that souls become, we'll say, overwhelmed in attempting to come up with all the answers. Sometimes they ignore and have to certain types of karmic issues, trying to avoid them rather than to include them. Other times they want to include them because they think we'll be able to solve that part of the equation in ourselves. And each time we solve an effect of a cause that we did that was substantially destructive to the growth of God, then we gain in consciousness and we develop ourselves closer to our Creator. So it's a good thing to try to do it. Again, provided it doesn't overwhelm us and leave us into a virtual vegetative state where we can't do anything. That's not going to help. Okay. So that's part of the whole equation in terms of souls. Another part is, and this is the strange part of it, is that just whether or not we stay the same sex or change our sex. On an average, we have about 3 lifetimes as a particular sex, and then we flip. But not always. Some people go on for more than that. Some may have just 1 or 2 and change. There's a lot of reasons for that. And after a certain stage where a person becomes very advanced in their spiritual development, they actually stay at the same sex at the time that they finished a certain part of their spiritual development. So for most people, it's a concern, but for those really advanced people, they're just going to stay at a certain sex. And so the soul decides, well, is this a time to change sex or is this a time not to? It has a pretty profound effect on the way the monastic body is developed because it flips, it actually mirrors from one side to the other in terms of how it reads and understands thought. And that changes a lot of perspective on the personality side. So there's a big difference between men and women is their personality development because it comes from their mental development. And so this is, because that's where the personality lives, that's where it exists, is in our lower mind. And this is something that I think a lot of people have come to, in some ways, informally believe, but they don't know the whole metaphysical principle of it or the physics of it. So we can talk a little bit about that. And that's one of the concerns that the soul is having, is that if you become too personality driven along one of the sex lines, either male or female, then it becomes negative. The personality is not seen as particularly helpful as you grow older, as we grow older. And you want to diminish some of its controlling factors after a certain point. Well, one of the problems is if you don't change the sex of the person every so often, that personality becomes much more obstinate to change and much more obstinate to giving up control and can learn to become a personality disorder if it continues in that way. And so this is a reason to change sex. And it is a pretty good reason, actually. There are other factors that also come into play. Men and women each have strengths and weaknesses. These strengths and weaknesses need to be used for the creation of virtue while a person is alive. If a person uses a strength mostly for harming virtue or being destructive along the dark side of existence, maybe even evil, then one of the best things you can do is to change your sex. That will help. The soul is allowed to do that, except in people who become evil and give up their soul, and then they choose their sex, which is more often male than female, and that makes them even more evil and less likely to be anything other than personality-driven rather than soul-like. But for the rest of us folks, because those are the few and far between, hopefully, and they'll remain that way, for the rest of us, it's a pretty good deal, pretty good thing, to change sex. Now, some people are uncomfortable with this idea because they may be a little homophobic or whatever, and they think, oh, God, I don't want to be someone of the opposite sex. A few people may feel the opposite. It'd be cool to be, you know, the opposite sex. But the rationale is not based upon that kind of sentiment. Rather, it's really a practical matter. And if you see yourself using your sex characteristics in ways that are negative towards others, that is a sign that you may be born of the opposite sex. And if you're doing the reverse, if you're trying to be truly, you know, sort of sexually altruistic and also virtuous, especially in the way that you manifest your own sexual presence and your sex presence, not just sexual, but sex presence, now, because it's more than just a sexual issue. It's the whole gamut of what it means to be a certain sex, because I don't want to get into it just being a sexual factor. Then that person most likely will be reborn in that same sex, more likely than not, unless they have a lot of other karma from the past that hasn't been dealt with. Then there's other issues that come into play. Also, the same principle can be applied by the soul to many other areas of life. In almost any circumstance where a person is functioning that is in discord with creation of virtue, where they're on a darker path, the soul is going to change the next personality. So that person, not just in the sex sense, but in a lot of other ways, to be considerably different from and not similar to the last person that it creates, because it doesn't want to have another failure. And repetition will produce more failure than change will in most circumstances. Okay, let me say that again. If the soul determines that there's reasons for us doing things that are very negative, those parts of our personality, those traits that we have, will not be given to us in a propensity to have again in our next life. If you're presently, in a practical sense, although we're going to cover this later in the show, in a practical sense, if you're concerned, therefore, about like saying, well, gee, I don't want to be like this person or that person, I want to be like this, like I am now, or similar to the way I am now, then you better live your life very virtuously, because that's the only potential guarantee, it's not a guarantee, but reinforcement of the probability, that you're going to be born that way and have a similar life again. So the better you live in virtue, the more you create light around you and in the forms around you, that's what virtue is, the greater the propensity for you to come back in a similar way in your next life. Some people may not like themselves as they are right now, and that may be a consideration for making a lot of changes, because they know they don't want to be who they are. Now, that doesn't mean they should be bad. They shouldn't be trying to be worse because they don't want to be the way they have been. That's just kind of a contradiction in terms. If you don't like yourself, then try to become more virtuous, and you'll start liking yourself more, and you'll also have a greater chance of being reborn in that way that you do like yourself. That's the real point. All right, so you can see where the soul's coming from, I hope. in this general, we'll say, defining part of the show. And it's really has a very practical set of values that is applying. A lot of people think that souls are not really practical beings. Like, we're the practical ones, the souls are the metaphysical, whatever. Kind of mystical beings don't pay attention to the practical sides of life, and they kid themselves with that, and they make up excuses for all their significantly negative dispository things that they're doing that are destructive to themselves and others, saying, well, the soul doesn't have to deal with these practical things. It's the exact opposite. You see, the soul is very practical, and it's actually concerned about the most detailed of specifics about how people live. And we shouldn't consider otherwise except by fantasies that people have about souls and by a few misguided representations in some mystical literature. So it needs to be here at this point, really, I guess, explained that in their practical side, a soul is seeking for a really positive outcome. And they're not driven by the goal of some kind of success in terms of wealth or knowledge or whatever. Their goal, again, is for us to be co-creators with our Creator, themselves being part of the process, and that we are creating more light in the world and helping others to do the same. That's their goal. Our wealth or our status in social circles or whatever is relatively meaningless other than how it could, if it does, affect our ability to create virtue. So there could be times when those things do come to play because they have some effect on those issues. Let me give you an example. I've heard this from some people, by the way, so I'm going to try to break through this illusion. Some people have told me, well, I don't really care how I come across socially with other people because I'm a spiritual disciple. And I'm a very soul-driven person, and so it doesn't matter whether I put on niceties or if I follow certain types of conventions, so to speak, like, not swearing or doing other things, because all that is irrelevant to a soul. Really? Okay. But here's the point. Since the soul is concerned about how we help other people to be more virtuous, if we're turning off all those other people because they're walking around using swear words all the time and being destructive jerks in the way that we behave or misbehave and not showing empathy or concern for other people simply because we don't like them maybe, we have a real contradiction. And the soul doesn't live with those contradictions. We do. The soul says, no. You need to be concerned. Even though you may think it's trite or strictly a matter of convention, you need to be concerned about how other people respond to you. Even though you think they're being a hypocrite or they're doing this or that, there has to be some concern for that because if you completely turn them off, even if you're doing something virtuous after that, you've turned them off. And you're not going to be able to help them to further find their soul and to be more creative. So to some extent, sometimes we have to be somewhat dishonest, maybe, to ourselves and say, well, gee, I don't really want to be conventional. I want to be super unconventional because that's who I am. But in that unconventional manner, we are producing very negative effects on those around us. Because they reject us, and then they don't see the good things we're doing. They don't respond to us as souls because they see us rejecting them in our refusal to accommodate and become somewhat tolerable to them. And so the results can be very negative. Now, I know that some people, and I know some, I've talked to people like this, feel that this is totally wrong, and what I'm saying has to be against what souls want. Souls want us to be just our own thing, and who cares how we affect anyone else? But that's not true. I'm trying to lead us into a different understanding of this process. Souls work together, and they cater sometimes to the whims of other souls who have different thoughts and ideas. They do so not just because they are open-minded, which they are, but also because they want those others to be more open-minded as well. And they recognize in some circumstances there's a need to go over 50%, maybe over 60 or 70 or 80% to reach out to people. Not because you want to be a hypocrite or a do-gooder, but because you recognize that you're going to lose that person if you don't. Now, I do this all the time under certain circumstances, and sometimes I don't do it. When I don't do it, I know I'm wrong later on. But the point is that I do carry this out quite frequently because I recognize I can't just be myself around a lot of different people. Myself is sometimes a bit on the strange and radical side, to say the least. And if I present that to them before they know me fairly well and can trust some of the things about me, then the results can be very negative. And as much as I try to be of service to people, I'm driving them away then from my own service and from helping them to be co-servers as well. This is how the soul sees things, in my opinion. You may have a different one, of course. And you can call in right now if you want to disagree with me or whatever. But that's okay. Or write me an email and say you don't like me. But the point is that this is what I understand about souls. It's my understanding, and I'm owning it right now. All right. What else does the soul need in terms of its plans for its criteria for plans? Well, it is particularly concerned about those who are going to reincarnate with us on an intimate level. Those people somewhat are queued up from prior lives. We don't know about that. The soul does. And it keeps that in mind. It also is concerned about those relationships we're in, have been in, or are in, or going to be in this life thing. And it's a real big issue. Again, this is I'm picking the things that are the most critical, because there's a lot of minutiae sort of stuff that we won't have time to talk about tonight. But these are the biggies. So our relationships that are close have profound effects on us and the others that we're close with. Now, those relationships can be paternal, they can be any kind of relationship, but if they're of a close nature, the soul wants to ensure that those relationships are going to end up being a positive outcome of some sort. Now, you can ask yourself, well, what happens if you try? And this is, again, we'll deal with more of this in the next part of the show, but what happens if you try? You try to be friendly, helpful, loving towards people that you are close to, and they respond badly. What if it's in their nature to consistently respond badly? The soul's answer for this is really interesting, and I want you to think about this, because this is a criteria the soul uses in giving us certain traits, and that is the best thing that we can do in those situations is to distance ourselves from those who have very bad reactions to us, instead of continuing the process of, we'll say, butting our heads against the wall. Now you might say, well, why? Why would you do that? Well, because if you know better and you realize the other person is going to respond this way and they're not changing over a reasonable period of time, your best bet is to let them be. Let them find other people to be close with, and you go on to do the same, and to leave that relationship alone, because it becomes toxic to both parties. It doesn't have a good outcome. Even if you're the willing party to try to make it better, if that's going to be the general outcome, then it's not good to pursue it. So knowing when to stay in and do everything you can, and knowing when to say quits, is one of the things that the soul wants us to understand and learn, and it tries to build in necessary life crises and other things that pushes us when we don't. And you could say, wait a second, you're saying that things are planned out for us failing at certain areas of life so that we will change? Yep, absolutely. As a matter of fact, if you use progression in horoscopes, that's somewhat what people are really learning about. These crises are there because each crisis is an opportunity of growth to get over the things that we haven't been changing. Some of those things we don't change have to do with leaving areas of our life that we have been tenaciously not willing to let go of, especially in terms of relationship with other people, and especially when those relationships with other people are us trying to help them, and they aren't willing to be helped. Sometimes you have to go to the opposite end of the spectrum. Now, let's talk about that. This is something that's going to, I know another thing that people think other than souls. That's something other than what souls think. But souls do believe that sometimes the only way to resolve, resolve something between two people is if one of the people is truly dark, maybe even evil, you may have to get into a conflict with them. The conflict may be, even in the physical world, one of force and maybe violence. Now, this is odd, because nobody wants to believe that souls really think this way. But souls do. Why do it? Because as a practical matter, according to metaphysical principles that I believe souls follow, again, this is my opinion, the souls and our soul believes that it's sometimes necessary to enter into a confliction with a person or persons to be of any service to them, because what they're doing is so destructive as a general principle to not only you but possibly to others, that if you don't do that, you're acting as an unwilling participant. You're actually helping them. You're enabling them to continue what might be very evil behaviors. Now, I know some people say, well, if you're a soul, you're a peace-loving pacifist, and you never raise a hand against anybody, and you stand there like the Christians being devoured by the lions, and you turn the other cheek. I know that that's something some people believe. I know it. And it's unfortunately not correct. There's a time to be strong, and sometimes even to fight and be. If violence approaches you, you may need to, if you can't escape it, then you may need to be violent back. But most of the time, it isn't a violent issue. It's a conflict issue, but hopefully not a violent one. Whatever it is, it does require that people stand up to the dark side and to be willing to fight and sometimes put their life on the line for the preservation of the light. Now, that doesn't mean that you should be going out and willy-nilly knocking off people who are doing bad things to people. I'm talking about areas where the conflict comes to you and you can't do anything about it. Now, you can't deal with all the conflicts in the world because you wouldn't be doing anything else other than that. But you can deal with the conflicts that come to you because there's a karmic reason for it. And if you don't resolve the karma, it'll come back again. And your soul expects you to enter into the conflict and resolve it in some way. If you can't resolve it through love and through partnership and help, then the only resolution will come through in a struggle, which will become a conflict that you need to bring the other side, the other people, to a better place. That's the only thing you can do. And unfortunately, it isn't your choice. It isn't your, you don't have, we don't have the choice to make other people more loving. We can't make it happen. We can produce results where we prevent them from being destructive to us, including to us. But we can't make them be more loving. So it's the crisis itself that allows them the opportunity to become more loving, usually after they have reached so much force through what we're doing and others, that they are prevented from carrying out any further their destructive evil. That's about how it works. I know that doesn't sound very soul-like, but again, I'm not here to talk about things that people want to believe souls are like. I'm talking about the practical side of their plans. And this is what I not only believe, it's not a belief, but what I have come to understand and what I have to observe. Some of it is by observation. Okay, so let's continue. What else are the plans of a soul, and why? What are the criteria that they're using, and the conditions of areas of concern? Well, one of the biggies, and I know that a lot of people, you know, you hear this, I want a soulmate, you know. One of the biggies seems to be the question of an intimate partner who usually is sexually involved with us and who is a long-term, maybe life, at least in terms of physical life, long partner. How does that enter into the soul's understanding? Well, that partner is getting as close as to us as anybody usually is going to get. And so the soul's concern there is our ability to handle the most intimate, the most important in terms of both our personal and our soul interest relationships, and how that turns into creating virtue. The results are usually this. When the soul experiences a growth in light in a person because they're having a relationship with another who is the most intimate of partners to that person, then in those situations, and especially if monogamy is involved, because that's what makes it truly a relationship of light, if you're having these with 10 other people, believe me, you're not having a close enough relationship. But that's a different subject, I realize. But souls do not consider that the highest and best use of our intimate closeness. It's monogamy. Okay, so getting back to what I'm suggesting. The soul, and not just monogamy, but also fidelity to the one person, period. In other words, this isn't just a question of sexual monogamy. It's monogamy in terms of personal and soul monogamy. You're becoming joined as souls together in some respects. That's what I'm getting at. The soul is looking for this because it gives us the clearest window into the nature of ourselves, and it allows us to exhibit a type of love that we won't be able to do with most other people most of the time. So this is really important to the soul. And the areas, in terms of the relationships that we do this in ways that create light, the soul wants us to continue in those relationships. But if it's not producing light, then the soul wants us to move on to find a relationship where the one will be so produced, both for us and our other and our partner. So staying together for the kids or for whatever other reason, it doesn't make any sense because it's against the better judgment of the soul itself, based upon its way of looking at these sort of things. I hope that makes some sense to you. Now, again, this was just the first part of the show to define what we mean by soul's plans. And the next part, we'll get to some practical matters and get a little bit more into, well, what if I'm doing this or that, and et cetera. So we're going to take a break for right now, and we'll be back in, oh, give or take, about 2 minutes and 30 seconds from about right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And I was just talking with Seth, our engineer, and he had a great experience last week being around a lot of people who were loving their life and trying to do it together. And I thought that was a good thing. They all went on a trip together to do that. I think 1,000 or more of them did that. Okay, so here we are into the practical side of tonight's show. I call it more practical because usually in the beginning of the show, until the first break, we talk about the science, the defining elements, the criteria of what I'm going to explain later. But then we move into more practical parts of it, which is good too. So what does this mean in terms of our living our life in a physical realm? Well, let's talk about what physical life is like, because that has a lot to do with our soul's plans, with our plans, and for what most people want as a next lifetime. There's no more difficult life on an average than the physical world life. It's many, many times harder to live than the astral world life, which is, of course, next. So the reason for that is that the energy is extremely dense and uncooperative. It doesn't follow our thinking very well. And it kind of is doing its own thing, which is oftentimes not necessarily co-creating with God. It's kind of like wanting to join with other energy and just be big and powerful. You know, that kind of is the basis of how evil gets started. It's people want to be big and powerful and do their own thing. That's not coincidental. That is consistent with them becoming so grounded in the illusion of being energy rather than spirit. So what happens is our spirit side, while we're physically alive, really takes a beating. It isn't able to come out and manifest itself very easily because the physical world, the energy around us, is so demanding and so forceful towards us. These forces that we live in and sometimes create against us are incredibly, we'll say, preventative of us developing ourselves spiritually. They lead us into continually thinking about and taking actions that in some way deal with some material outcome, either making more money or having more power and control or seeking to have things as a representation of ourselves, the consciousness of who we are, rather than that consciousness being an outgrowth of our spirit and of our spiritual existence. This leads, unfortunately, away from both spiritual life and God. Spirit is God's thought. So we stop thinking about God, and we think more and more about the material world and outcomes that are almost strictly material. Everything is predicated upon some material basis. Am I going to make more money or not? Am I going to get more things or not? Is this going to be a cool thing for me or not? Am I going to have fun and excitement or not? Those kinds of outcomes produce a almost intoxicating and totally illusioned perspective. It makes us into what we are valuing so highly, which is energy. It makes us into an object. And you could say, well, what about people who are into sex? Well, yeah, physical sex. That's what they're into. You see, that's the point. Physical sex and things like that, that isn't love. That's a physical outcome, and it is definitely an energy outcome. It involves bodies and form. It may not have any spirit involved in it at all. Even if it has some, the focus is on the physical element. More so for men than women. I talked about sex being a difference, and that's true about the sex element in men being more on the material side, because that's a masculine trait, because the physical dimension is a masculine dimension. Women are more attuned to the more spiritual elements of sex as an average. Not every woman is like that, and not every woman is like that all the time. But on an average, they are more like it than men, for whatever good or bad reason you want to believe. But I think it's not good, and men have to be concerned about that. But that's just one element. It gets into all kinds of things. You know, women could be just as attached to shoes or to other kinds of elements of dress or appearance. And it could be a lot of other material factors. Men like their toys, as we sometimes say. They like a lot of contraptions that make them more powerful by their being able to either drive them, move them, change them, that sort of thing. They also like the sensation of power. So men like fast cars. Women might too, but not as often as men, because the sensation of power is sometimes an antidote for a lack of having it. And when a person feels powerless, they may substitute at times that element. Is that a good or bad thing? Not necessarily. But the point is, if they don't understand that that's what they're doing, it's a very bad thing, because then they may lose the spiritual side of things if that's where most of their attention goes to. And it's not that we should deny the physical world, because the physical world is where we're here. We're here to understand it. And one of the things to understand about is what I just said about power and all this stuff is things to learn while we're here. We wouldn't know it if we didn't come here and experience it. But we can't be seduced by it, and we can't be controlled by it, because then the outcome of the physical life is one in which we weren't conscious. And it's very negative. It can produce some terrible effects, because as people become more material, they commensurately become less spiritual, and they also do terrible things to others. Why? Because they objectify the others. They don't see the others as spiritual beings. They see the others as physical beings. Physical beings, it's pretty hard to have much compassion for. Physical beings, it's pretty hard to have much respect for. Physical beings, it's pretty hard to have much closeness with and understanding at the same time. So these things get messed up, and physical life produces the mess. It's the illusions. And that comes from our inability to sense and our inability to think correctly while in physical form. It's just the nature of who we are. And you could say, well, what about souls? Souls would know the difference. Yeah, they do when they're in the higher mental world where they hang out. But if they came here, they would be no different from us because they would have to have senses that would be overrun and overwhelmed by physical energy, the same as us. They would have to have personalities. Why? Because the soul thinks too much of others. And in this world, if you think like a soul and you aren't wise of this world, not just wise as a soul, but of this world, you'll be destroyed by others. The soul can't be here. They would be destroyed by themselves and their own mistakes and by others. So they create us and give us a personality, a controlling thing that is tough and resilient, but not exactly what you would call conscious. And they give us a self, which is conscious, but he has to grow and understand and learn something new in each lifetime, a lot of things. And they give us senses, and the senses are overwhelmed by the energy because that's just the way the energy is, both in our senses and in the world around us. So between the personality working with these faulty senses and the fact that we're in a sea of unwilling, demanding energies that create tremendous forces for us, we screw up, and we can't be our souls here. And our souls can't come here and be here, or else they would be, because this is a mess the way it has to be done. But that's the way God created the world, so that we could be independent of our souls to some extent, and we can live our life and gain an understanding of the physical world and learn a balance between material and spiritual life. You can't get rid of material life and say, well, I'm going to live in a cave and just meditate and all that stuff. No, you can't do that, because then it's just like you didn't come here in the first place. What use is that? You're here to make a change. Co-creation is the name of the game. Creation is the big word. So the lesson to be learned is to be creative and co-create with God in light rather than in darkness, away from God. Then you have to have a balance between spirit and energy, between spirit and form. That's what it's supposed to be like. How do you achieve that balance? Well, this is one of the big questions of the mystical sciences for the ages. And now it's not so mystical, at least not on this show. The balance is best achieved through little trials and errors and through great conceptual understandings put together. Just because you have the right concepts doesn't mean you're going to do it right. And just because you try and do it all the time, if you don't have the right concepts, you're probably not going to succeed. It's a tough one. Again, it has this tremendous balance in every respect. Is it possible? Yes. Is it possible to be perfect at it in one lifetime? No. Is it possible to be perfect at it over hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes? Eventually. However, it's going to be, for most people, a long time. Let's talk about that. We have one lifetime right now, but we're going to have hundreds of physical lifetimes. We're probably in the hundredth, some odd, 200, 300, 400, 500 lifetime. Most people will be in the physical world for around 800 lifetimes or so. In that ballpark. And that's a lot of lifetimes. Quite a few when you think about it. And each lifetime will last anywhere from, well, I would say today it will average probably 75, 80 years, but in the past it was less, and in the deep past it was more. And eventually it'll get up to over 100 years as an average. That's how long we're going to live. And how long is it on an average between lifetimes? About 100 years. Really? In the 100 to 130, 140 year range, yeah. It's in that ballpark. So people born today lived about 100 years ago, physically, in the physical world. And so on an average, some of them lived more, some of them lived a little less. If you die suddenly and young, there's a chance you'll come back earlier. So there's some people have said about karmic issues. People who died, a lot of people who died during World War II, a tremendous proportion of the population of the world did. You have to remember that. Those people came back earlier. Some came back in 30, 40, or 50 years. So that's a thing to be concerned about. There was a flood of people coming in during the 80s who actually had been in one way or another affected by World War II and killed during that time. That's real early, by the way. Because they were killed early, sometimes as youngsters, sometimes as late teenagers. I mean, let's face it, most military people, most soldiers, are just late teenagers, early 20s people, right? That's who we send over to get killed. And they come back sooner than later, usually. But there's other things that are involved, the karmic things. I will get to try to describe some of that during tonight's show, but for right now, just in general speaking, we can expect about 100 years, give or take, plus or minus 40, maybe, about when we're coming back. And, you know, it's a difficult thing for most people to fathom because you say, well, I can't remember my last physical life. I can't remember even any life. Well, in order to have memory, you had to have created virtue more than half the time, about 60%. And if you're only creating virtue 2% of the time that you are awake and conscious in your life today, you certainly weren't doing much more than that in your last life. Not likely. So you're not going to remember anything. Why not? Because memory is created by commonality of consciousness. Not by commonality of events, but by commonality of consciousness. And if you're only really conscious to the point where you can remember from one lifetime to the next while you're creating virtuous things, and that only is 2% of the time you're alive, it's not enough to connect any of those virtuous things together. You won't remember them. Maybe only as a fleeting moment you'll have some vague memory of something. But that's not real memory. Real memory takes about 60%. This has been discovered by psychologists. 60%. You have to remember of events and have a conscious connection from one event to the next to have a memory. Very important to realize this if you're dealing with Alzheimer's or any kind of dementia, because that's one of the reasons people start to forget. They lose their consciousness in the connection from one event to another. And if they don't have at least 60%, they don't have memory. Okay. So that's a big deal. That's the reason we don't remember. Children do better at remembering their last life because they're closer to it. And they're only dealing with a limited form of consciousness that's with their physical body. Before 7 years old, children remember much more about their last lifetime, which they start to forget as they develop their astral and mental bodies more, which have a lot less, we'll say, basic connections. And also, what they remember in their last lifetime is more connected to them in a natural way, through virtue, because children are before 7 years old tend to be more virtuous than adults. We call them innocent, but they're not really innocent. They just haven't learned to be as greedy and selfish in some circumstances. In others, they may have. Depends on how they were raised. But some children do. Particularly virtuous kids, really good kids, have significant numbers of them, have some memory of their last life before 7. Oftentimes before 5 or 6. By 7, they start forgetting. Think about it yourself. You might remember when you used to have some memory. I know, that's a tough one. Wow, let's give you a break. How's that? And we'll come back to some of these practical issues. I find this really interesting. I hope you're finding it to be of value and interesting as well. So we'll come back to this. I just want to tell you that we are actively promoting Bai Chi Jizik at this point. It's being very successful. Many people are finding it's helping to relieve pain and all kinds of different pain. One of the biggest issues is the way people take it. It's not like drugs, and it isn't dealing with the demonic energies that cause pain in the same way drugs do. Most drugs, particularly narcotics, tend to shut down the demonic energies. When they shut down the demonic energies, they lessen the amount of pain because the energy itself, these are little energy beings, various centers of our body, but not our physical body as much as what I'm talking about is our nervous system or our etheric or electromagnetic body. And this is part of the physical body, but part that many people don't know about. Okay, so during the expression of a demonic energy in the nervous system, which corresponds to the nervous system, it's sending out a signal that says, ouch, 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 I'm in pain, I'm in pain, I'm in pain. And we may notice a signal and say, yes, I'm in pain, but I don't want to be in pain. I know I'm in pain. I even know why I'm in pain, so it isn't going to do me any good to experience more of it. Okay. But this poor little energy being is just not that conscious. I mean, what do you expect? It's there just to report. It isn't there to discern between good pain, bad pain, or we know the reason for it, so there's no sense in having it at this point, kind of pain. It doesn't work that way. It can learn by the way. You can actually teach it to do that, but that's a whole different thing. And then you really have to become a really, you know, you're going to have to do some kind of serious yoga work with that type of energy to change it to do that. But you could. But for most of us, that's not going to happen. Okay, so we want to turn off the pain, right? Okay. Way one, hit it with a narcotic. Narcosis, that'll work. Put it to semi-sleep, numb the hell out of it, and force it to stop saying, I'm in pain, I'm in pain, I'm in pain. It goes, I'm in pain. That's all it could do. Can't get anything else out. Okay. So we narked it. Fine. But you know what? Each time you narc it, that little energy being says, wait a second. You're not going to get away with that with me. I'll just get more forceful. And it learns to start counteracting the drug. And next time, you're going to take more drug to get it to shut up. Okay? And each time we do this, we're damaging other demonic energies that give us senses other than pain. So we're making ourselves senseless people. And then we're getting much worse information from our environment, and we're turning ourselves into addicts. Because we like the senseless feeling, some of us do, others don't, and we may take this stuff just to become senseless. Oh, that's wonderful. It also helps you deal with emotional pain then. Yeah, it does. Shut off everything. But the point is, every time you do it, it becomes less effective. What about Jesus? What about Bai Chi Jizik? Bai Chi Jizik doesn't turn off the nervous. Says, hey, you guys, you're being affected by too much energy. That's the reason you think there's so much pain. How about sending some of that energy that you're calling pain over to some other centers? They can handle it over there. And it helps direct by using phytochemicals. That's where the phi part comes from. It helps to direct the chi energy, which is what this energy that's stuck here is doing. It's where it comes from. It's called chi. And it's one of the three kundalini energies, the first energy of the kundalini. So it actually comes from the earth. But at any rate, that's maybe getting off the subject. So the Bai Chi Jizik has all these different herbs that are plants that have chemicals in them that are other types of demonic energies that have learned to help out the devas in our body. And they know how to do it even before they get into our body. So they get in there and they say, oh, we're going to redirect the energy now to a new site away from this one that is contaminated with too much energy, to a site that maybe doesn't have enough energy and it's screaming out, and I don't have enough energy, I don't have enough energy, and I'm in pain now. So you can have pain from too much energy or not enough energy, and either way, it's a bad thing. But if you balance the system, that's what balances, from the too much side to the too little side, both sides say, hey, I'm not in pain anymore, not in pain anymore, and they stop hurting you. Another good thing is the devas become more conscious by taking Cheezik, not less. And you're not turning off any of the other devas that you're using for your senses, so you still can sense everything up to a point. If you take a huge, huge, huge amount of 5G Cheezik, that part may not be true. You get a little imbalance if you take too much. But that's the worst that can happen. The worst that could happen is you maybe have an allergic reaction to it, because a few people, not very many, may have an allergic reaction. And if they do, they have to stop taking it. They shouldn't use it. But most, that's like having an allergic reaction to food or any other thing, because that's what this stuff is. It's also food, right? Herbs. Okay, so most people have a really good response. Vichy Jesus does a great thing. However, with a drug, you take as little as possible to get the job done. With Jesus, you take a lot. Why? You start off taking a lot because that's when you need it the most, because you got to redirect this energy, and it takes a lot to move it because it's stuck. Once it gets moving, each time you take the Jesus, it works better and better because it's already got momentum. It's already moving in the right direction. It takes less Jesus to move it again. And less Jesus is good. So you start off with maybe a huge amount, 10 tablets. It's a lot, huge amount. And you work your way down to maybe a couple, maybe 3-4 tablets. Instead of every 6 hours, you're taking them 2 or 3 times a day. And you're getting equal or more pain relief from that. You're also doing something else. By moving the energy around, you may be solving the problem because it's more causal. You're dealing with the real reason there's pain. The real reason, not just the pain itself. There are a lot of real reasons. And unfortunately, those reasons are named in Western science as illness. So we can't tell you about those real reasons because it's against the law to treat an illness with herbs, unless you're a medical doctor. But then you'd be prescribing, or the equivalent. You have to have some kind of license to prescribe. And the FDA doesn't let you do that. See, doesn't let us do that. But unfortunately, we do something that drugs don't do. We're not a drug. And they don't understand it. But I'm explaining it to you guys, so you do. So you need to try Cheezik, but you need to try it at a large enough amount to begin with. So you redirect the energy, just get it moving, and then take it again and take it again. Lesser amounts as you move on with it. And you'll know when you hit the right amount the first time you take it, because the pain will mostly or all go away. And then you take a little bit less. First, you take it every 6 hours, then you might go to every 8, and 3 times, then twice a day, and maybe once a day eventually. It all depends on the nature of what is going on. Remember, Cheezik ultimately is going to heal you, although we can't say that. I can't, because it's my opinion. But we can't, and say it as a we being. The company that makes it can, because that's not something that's allowed to be said. Terrible, terrible stuff. But anyway, hopefully that will clear up some people's misunderstandings about the science of Fai Chi, because really this applies not just to Fai Chi Jizik. We're making a number of different nutraceutical-type products that are herbal, organic, etc., and these products are amazing, but they're very different in the way you use them, much better in their ultimate effects and outcome. Give it a try, and remember to use it the way suggested. You can't make it like an aspirin. You can't take two and call us in the morning. You may take 10, and 6 hours later take 8. And then 7 or 8 hours later take another 6. That may be the way to use it for the kind of pain you have. Also, you can't have been using a lot of drugs, especially narcotics, and use GZIC, because you're doing the opposite of what the GZIC does. The drug interferes. We have found that sometimes when people take acetaminophen and certain other very mild, what are called OTC drugs, it can work with GZIC. You can get some balance sometimes. What happens is it's on the other side. The drug doesn't help to move the energy, but what it does do is it mitigates the effects of the energy pouring into places where there's a lack of energy. It changes the effect on that side so you don't have as much tension, because that's what happens when you have energy moving to the areas where there's lacking energy. You get tension. And acetaminophen and some types of other drugs, like a thing called methylcarbinol, used to be called Robaxin. Those kinds of drugs help on the side that don't have enough energy. And as they get energy, they're not used to it, so it's good to give them a little bit of a help. And the GZIC can't do quite as good a job alone as it can sometimes with those. Especially when people have things like severe migraines. The migraines produce so much tension in the body. It's anything in or around the head, very tension-producing. From the neck up, just any kind of pain there is very tension-producing. Then sometimes it helps to take a drug. Now, I'm also not supposed to tell you that either, but I'm going to tell you that. I mean, you know, what the heck. But at any rate, so that's how it all works. I hope this makes some sense to you, because we have people that understanding. They think when they're taking GZIC, they're taking a drug. They're not taking a drug. And you can't use it like a drug. Even though the instructions tell you right off how to use it, people don't know. They don't want to believe it. So I hope this has made some sense. Let's get back to the plans of the soul and talk about our next life and see where we're going from there. Okay. I find it extremely interesting to get into this subject and realize that a lot of people are living their lives in ways in which they're producing huge amounts of forces against themselves by not realizing they are not balancing their life spiritually with the material world. This is probably the single most cause of people finding everything from illness to destructive relationships to financial disasters to you name it. It's caused by that. Now, evil can affect anybody, but it usually tends to go after those that are producing the most good. So evil is a real terrible thing, and so is darkness. And evil is around us, and so is darkness. And the effects can sometimes be troublesome. But most people are actually creating most problems themselves. They don't, and evil doesn't pay attention to those people because they don't have to. The person's so self-destructive, just let them do their own thing. Hey, they'll do it for themselves. You know? People that live seeking power, control, money, material things, and material outcomes to their relationships with other people are inevitably going to face a lifetime or more of terrible forces. Now, the interesting thing is, in the beginning, they may not notice that because karma is slow to take place, and it could take decades. So the person may die before it fully becomes realized how bad they were living while they were physically alive. And then they will have to come back in some other lifetime and deal with some of those causes they put into motion. May not be their next one, for sure. what can we do about this, imbalancing our spiritual side with our physical side, since we know that this is the single most important issue to make a change about? Well, I would suggest read. Not to be too self-aggrandizing, but it would help probably to read Life's Hidden Meaning. It would help to read Afterlife Love. It would also help to read a huge amount of other metaphysical and spiritual sources to gain a better understanding in general of this topic. Getting a balance means taking notice of the soul itself. The soul already has the balance. You've got to get back to the basics of recognizing that we are not here as totally independent beings. We are here interdependent with our soul and God, if we choose to, and we're only totally independent if we turn away from God and get into this life of materialism at such an extreme measure as some people do. It doesn't mean that you're evil because you're a materialist. It means you may be darker than a lot of people, but it doesn't mean you're evil. Recognizing the soul in yourself and others, though, is one of the ways to get out of this quandary. What does it mean to recognize it's your soul? Well, you need to use the two senses that oftentimes people are ignoring, especially in the physical body. These two senses recognize and understand God on the one side, that's the heart chakra, in its full development and openness. And then when fully open and developed, the head chakra, or crown chakra, tells us ways we can co-create with God. We need the first, the heart, before we can understand and use the second one. A lot of people don't have these centers very well open because they pay very little attention to the information that comes from these centers during most of their life. How do you pay more attention to those centers? By paying less attention to the centers that people do pay attention to, the sexual center as one, especially men, the astral center as two, especially for women, and the throat center these days, because of the extreme measure of it being developed so much in people through the continual focus of it on our planet for 675 years or so through the third ray and the throat chakra in general. The throat center has to do with communication. People who are always on the internet, always on talking on their cell phone, texting on their cell phone or whatever, are contaminated by this energy. It's very bad. It's more seductive and more strangely destructive, and I said this years ago, than is the sexual energy or the astral energy. Sexual and not necessarily astral, but the emotional energy, as it relates to the physical center, though. So those two centers, even though they have profound effects and have for a long time, are now being and have been supplanted by the exaggeration of the throat chakra and your third ray in us, particularly in the physical body. If you find yourself in that type of behavior pattern, change. And I mean now, because if you don't, you're going to be reliving this lifetime almost guaranteed because you're not living up to your spiritual balance. You're out of balance spiritually. You need to be defocused from those things to focus on the heart and crown chakra. I can guarantee you can't achieve the balance if you're majorly focused on those three centers and particularly on the throat chakra. Now, some people that are very scientifically oriented sometimes are more focused on the Ajna center. Okay? And they, therefore, don't have spiritual balance. Not usually as severely out of balance as the other three centers, and particularly the throat chakra, but still, it's one of the things they can be affected by. What other kinds of conditions get into play? Well, only a few people have problems of over-focus on the sacral center, and those are the people who are spiritually ambitious. And they may be so focused on that center and so meditative and into themselves that they forget that they're here in the physical world to be out doing something that is physical outcome. Or they may be into physical outcomes, but only the ones that meet their criteria for what they believe is spiritual development. That's oftentimes the case in spiritual disciples. So if that's the thing going on, you got to change that too, because it blocks you again. It's an inequality, and it's still a material center, by the way. It blocks you from establishing a balance. Even though the sacral center is supposed to help in the balance, if it can become part of the problem, if that's the center you're mostly focusing on. Also, it can make you a hypocrite in a lot of other problems. So the thing you want to do is not be focusing, defocus onto these from these material centers, in sense, onto the heart and crown chakra, heart first. The first thing you want to do is you want to gain an understanding and super empathy for all other people. Super empathy is how much are you understanding where other people are at in a spiritual sense? How much are they representing God? How can you help them to represent God more? By co-serving, by teaching, by being of some compassionate help in some way, and by truly focusing out on them, not on yourself. That's a very good thing. If you focus on yourself through the heart chakra, it ends up being it goes to the sacral center, the energy, and it makes you more afraid of life, and it does not produce the beneficial effects I'm saying. It doesn't open the center, and the center doesn't become very, in any major sense, conscious, which is the critical element here if we're going to reach the level that I'm suggesting we need to in terms of spiritual balance versus material. Because it's this imbalance, again, in the material side that's leading to so many forceful bad outcomes for people, terrible outcomes. Even what people call accidents are not accidents. They're the result of sense deprivation, instruction, and poor judgment coming from a personality that puts whatever sense it does have, that's correct, together wrong and gets wrong information. Those are bad outcomes. Terrible outcomes, actually. And that's what's going on. That's what's happening. So even accidents, even the things that we think are not our fault, really are. And the soul realizes this. Our soul realizes this. As I speak to you about this, think about it. Re-listen to the show and see if it doesn't ring a bell. If it does, if you don't say, you know what? That guy's right on. I could just set that. Because if you're saying that to yourself, then you're awakening. Continue the awakening process. Okay, so first thing is defocus from the material world, but not give up on it. Because you're here in the material world to understand it and to use it for co-creative means. You can't create physically, if you're not part of the physical world, okay? Once you leave here, no more creation physical. It's gone. No more physical energy, no more body to interact with the world. Spirit has to have a body to work, to interact in all of the four lower dimensions of time and space. It has to have a body. So that's the requirement. Spirit and form come together to co-create with God. That's what the purpose is. God's mind is part of three parts. The third part has to join with the first two parts. The first two parts are spirit. The third part is form or energy. They have to join together to have a meaningful relationship with your creator. Okay, let's say that you get to the defocusing part. Then the next step is to refocus the same energies and intention into the heart chakra by developing a sense of super empathy. Not just empathy. Empathy alone is not going to do it for you. That's really coming from the solar plexus. God has super empathy, meaning that it's about God, not about how the other person feels. Oh, we're going to personally feel, Susie, Bobby, they're all feeling bad. We got to do something about it. No, you don't got to do nothing about anybody because of how they feel. You need to do something about what their soul needs in terms of what God needs and whether they're being co-creators. That's what the criteria are. If that's what you're doing, great. And if that isn't what you're doing some of the other thing, forget it. huge mistake, meaningless stuff, and you're on the wrong path, going to create enormous forces in your life, accidents galore, illnesses galore, terrible consequences. You'll be repeating a lot of this lifetime. And that's where you want to go. Okay? I'm sure that a lot of listeners tonight, I do not want to go there because that's not going to work. Okay. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to the show, right? I would expect that would be true. Okay, so that's the first step, is to get that super empathy going. But super empathy alone is not enough. You've got to then switch to the higher sense of the crown or head chakra. And that sense, which is the first type of ray energy sense, means you really got to become creative. And I mean you have to create new things with others that are enlightening, that are virtuous. These things could be physical things. They definitely involve the physical world, or they can be ideas that have physical outcomes, of course, that you let people gain some understanding about and co-participate with. You have to become a doer to do this. You can't be sitting around and meditating about it. It won't work. You can't read and achieve it. It won't work. You got to be a doer. It takes interaction with others who are of similar mind. And it works better when you do it with others as a group, because then your failings are bolstered by their strengths and vice versa, and there's a lot of other benefits that come from that kind of interaction. So that's an important part of the process. Can a person change? Yes. Can you do this effectively? Over a number of months, probably. Certainly within a few years. So if you're considering that you want to really make a difference, I'm going to tell you a little secret. You ready? No matter how badly you have lived to this point, no matter how much terrible things you've done, and that's going to be your karma, and some of it may not have worked out yet, if you start now doing this thing that I'm talking about, which is changing the focus, get away from the material side focus through the senses, change your focus to a spiritual balance form, within a few years, you can change the overall outcome, not just of this lifetime, but of future ones, especially your next physical life. You'll also have an effect on your astral and mental plane lives as well. So the benefits are tremendous. Now, do I want you to do it because the benefits are tremendous to yourself? No. I want you to do it because they're beneficial to your soul, who doesn't care about yourself, but cares about your higher self, which is part of its higher self, and it cares about you becoming a part of God, as it is. But nonetheless, a lot of people are first motivated by their concern about having a terrible lifetime, and maybe a next one as well. And so maybe that becomes their initial motive. It might be not the best motive. It may not be the perfect motive. But it's a place to get them moving. And sometimes you've got to go along with that with others, besides just with your own self, because that's what they're willing to do at the time, knowing that that will change as they become more conscious, as they become better understanding of what it is that they're really doing and why they're really doing it. So these are the things that I can say in general are very practical issues that can make a very significant difference to becoming someone who you really love on the highest levels and that you find the most incredible joy and bliss in existence. This is the kind of life that people, I think, really want. They just don't know how to get there or didn't know until maybe I'm explaining it. Okay, let's talk about some nitty-gritty practical things because I just gave all the conceptual side and I did give some practical issues of how to deal with it, but in a bigger way. But let's talk about some nitty-gritty things because I think that a lot of people have some questions about that, and they don't know exactly the answers. Let's say one of your nitty-gritty issues is the question of how much money should you have and for what purpose should you have it for? Okay. Here is an interesting point. It isn't a matter of how much money you should or do have. It's what your intended purpose is with the money, because money is a conserved time and energy, where you take it and you focus it together and you call it money. It's your time and energy from some prior time, now in your savings account, in your family safe, in maybe some other form, but it's there. If the money is there mostly for your own use, for some future material outcome, it could be a vacation, it could be a retirement, it can be for giving material things to others, be it grandchildren, children, friends, strangers, just giving it away because they want it and it'll make you feel good. Those are all bad reasons. Why are they bad reasons? Because they are material reasons. They are not spiritual reasons. Oh, but I thought giving to strangers. I'll give it to the blank foundation. I'll do it to this church down the road, if that's better. I'll just give it to people I don't know as I walk down the street. Why is that no good? Why does that not create a spiritual outcome? Because you don't know their soul. The criteria of soul issue is the bottom line. If you're not participating with their soul, if you're not co-creating with their soul, especially, because remember, you want to use both senses, both spiritual senses, then the outcome is material, even though you think it's not. But it makes them feel good. It makes me feel good. I had a good cry when I gave somebody $10 and they were starving. Yeah, maybe you did. But the point is, you didn't know what their soul was like. So giving unwisely is more destructive than not giving at all in many circumstances. And it certainly is self-destructive. And if you're not giving and you're just saying, well, I'm keeping it for myself because 5 years from now I want to take a long vacation, or 10 years ago, 10 years from now I'm going to retire and do all this stuff and I have all this money, and all the stuff you're going to do is just more material stuff. So you're going to become more material. You're saving your money to become more material as you get older. Wow, that's going to have a great effect on your next physical life. A really great one. I'm being facetious. Okay. Practical. It's not sense. It doesn't make sense. Not when you really think about it. If you've heard the rest of the show tonight, you're understanding where I'm coming from. If you just tuned in, you probably said, "Who's this nutcase saying we should have money? We should retire. We should, you know, go listen to Susie Orman or something." You know, you'll be better off if you've just tuned in, because you're probably not going to understand the rest of the show either. So it's not going to make any difference. Okay. So what should you do with your money? Highest and best use, which includes your own participation. Highest and best use. Be co-creative, if possible. Unless you absolutely, I mean, if you have some terrible malady, you're down to the last few days, your life. Highest and best use, then, is those that are going to use it for the sole purposes, the maximum sole purposes you could possibly think of. Who's going to do that? Is it going to be your best friend who has never done a good thing in their life, but because they're your best friend, you're going to give it to them? Or you're going to give it to some unknown foundation because you heard they do good things? but you never really figured out whether those things really are good things. You don't know. You don't know how many souls they're working with. They're just working with more people to give more money to for reasons that may be political power or something or some other crazy thing, or maybe the foundation itself is its own reason for existence. You don't know. But you do know if it's a soul factor. That's the basis. Really important. Why is this really important? Because almost everybody's making this terrible mistake. They're becoming more and more material as they grow older, not less so, as God intended. We're supposed to be getting wiser. And yet we have, particularly in the United States, and certain other fairly wealthy, well-developed, quote-unquote, countries, people say for a more material old age future. How crazy is that? Okay. So you want to use the money, if you're going to have any money, for the maximum use and die totally penniless. Don't die and let other people decide what they're going to do with your money or your material possessions, which are the same as your money. Use everything you have to co-create with God and to do so in ways that are soul basis, soul's plan, not your plans on a personal level. I know that hurts. A lot of people say, well, I have children. What am I going to do with my children? Well, treat them as souls. Are they doing the soul thing? If they are, then you don't have any problems, do you? But if they're not, you have a huge problem. You see, we all have built in us a personality, and personalities are familiar. They're not soul. They work by familiarity of common interests and common bonds, such as family, blood, quote-unquote, and interests, and common control factors, and common shared material issues. This is what the personality seeks, and it's contrary to the soul in many circumstances. You need to change your personality to a more soul position. It oftentimes requires some quote-unquote spiritual discipline. Not discipline from outside, but it's an inner discipline of this nature of ourselves to be familiar and to be shallow rather than to be soul and to be universal in our thought. Take some other practical sites. And I could go on with this one thing, probably do a whole show on just that one subject, but we don't have the time for it. So let's go on to some other things. What are you going to do with the things you have right now? Okay, most people have a lot of stuff. What are you going to do with those things to make sure that those things provide the most amount of soul rational reasons for their existence in your life and in that of others? Make sure they're used to provide others with the maximum level of support and help in their service, whatever that might be. I don't care. You may have $1 million sports car converted into 100 vans that serves a lot of people, or if the sports car itself will serve some money in some kind of spiritual endeavor, that you give it to them for that, or use it yourself, or combining uses together with yours and theirs. But make sure it's being done for spiritual service. It's being helping them to serve. Now, is there such a thing as helping yourself to serve? Can you buy a contraption and it gives you a massage? I haven't found one that does it very well, but by the way. We have a couple, something like that. I say we, the spiritual group I'm part of, has it. But the point is that, yeah, absolutely. Anything that helps you to be a better server is perfectly okay to do. You can have music, nice stereo. Listen to the stereo, fine. If it helps in your service, but not because you have the greatest best. I used to do that. Well, you had to be the greatest, best area, best everything. But it didn't help in my service, so that was something I didn't care. I stopped caring about. Needs to help in your service. Needs to be part of what it is that you are actually doing. Are the things you can do that are enjoyable that help in your service? Yes, this is where it gets touchy, though. Let's say, well, I enjoy flying all over the world. I like to get on an airplane and wham, you know, spend $10,000 on a trip to the Far East or go to some interesting place and observe it and so on. And that makes me a better surfer. Maybe. It takes you away from your service, most likely, especially if it's in a kind of protracted period of time. Is it okay to recreate? Yes. Recreation is when your levels of creation have fallen due to high levels of use. So recreation is okay in a minimalist level. But when it becomes a major factor of your material existence, and it is the focus of your life, guess what? Doesn't work. Then recreation has supplanted creation, and you're not creating anything. You're just expending what you have on doing the thing that is fun and that makes you feel better and you like doing. You see the difference. When do you recreate? When is it appropriate? At the time when you have expended tremendous amounts of service, and any further levels of creation will lower your effectiveness. Then it's time to recreate. Instead of to create. The recreation is really going back over what you've created through the material side of existence. That's a whole other show to talk about that. It's quite interesting, but it takes a long time to explain that. And we would run out of time if I just chose to take that one subject and explain it to you. But that's what it means. I've written several articles about that, which are very interesting and quite fascinating. But I'm giving you the general idea here so that you can use these principles without necessarily having to understand every nuance about it. Okay, so if you have been serving at a very high level, and you're maybe even beyond your normal abilities, you're into super abilities, we'll say, but you reach a point where your physical body, your astral body, and your mental body need to rest, the way you rest is through a thing called recreation, which is where you use the benefits of your service to help reconstruct your own bodies. And when you get them back up to a certain level, then you're back ready to go to creation again. And it usually is not very long. So if you find, well, I've been recreating for the last 7 years of my life, and I've had 2 days of creation and 2,000 days of recreation, that's a bunch of nonsense. Those are the people that are the real hypocrites and the people that you don't want to become one of them. But there's people around that I meet like that all the time. They tell me about all the events that they've gone to, thousands of them in some cases. There are these spiritual outpourings of people doing this and that. And basically, they're into doing these things that have absolutely nothing to do with service of anybody. But that's what they do. That's a mistake. Okay. That's a mistake. Well, I meditate when I go there with everybody. We have at least one or two meditations a day for at least a half hour. Whoa. Nothing wrong with meditation, provided that it is accompanied by spiritual service. If you just meditate and you don't serve, it's a material event. Material, not a spiritual. Ooh, that's an odd idea. Okay, what other kinds of practical concerns do we have? I mean, this is a show that probably could go on for the rest of existence because unfortunately there's so much about physical world life that that needs to be, we'll say, demystified and understood and or just explained. Okay, what about folks who are into drugs? Yeah, if you listen to the commercial, this kind of plays into what I'm talking about. I talked about 5-HT. The problem with drugs is that they never lead to spiritual service for people who live in the modern world. Now, if you lived at another time in another culture where part of the religion of that culture was to take a drug to have a spiritual event take place that then you apply to your service for the rest of your life, that's a different kind of thing. We don't live that way. That's not part of our culture. And so people that are into drugs and supposedly are tuning in and dropping out and getting high and having all these other things are into escaping the fact that they're not spiritually serving and instead are into the sensations of escape, which is to end emotional and mental pain and sometimes physical as well. It may also augment certain pleasurable experiences, from sexual to certain types of exciting kinds of, you know, like, oh, I'm going to go on a roller coaster while I'm high, smoke some pot and go on a roller coaster. I'm going to have a real spiritual experience. Now, totally non-spiritual, totally into the material world. The drug itself is the material world. You're introducing it as part of your physical system. And sometimes it can become quite expensive as well, depending upon what kind of drug we're talking about. And almost always it's destructive to the physical system over time, if not almost immediately, depending upon what drug we're talking about. Yeah, ecstasy? Oh, ecstasy doesn't do anything to you. It just destroys part of your mental thinking processes in a normal, logical way. And it has an effect on affect. It causes more affect. But it does a lot of other things as well. It may affect memory. It may destroy certain brain cells. But the worst thing that it's doing is that when you're into that sort of stuff, you are blocking off what is your heart and crown chakras, and you're not into understanding God or spiritually serving or co-serving with anybody else. You're into the experience of the drug, regardless of whether you believe that or not. And so that's a big issue. I know people say, oh, no, the drug's just opening up a whole realm of new experiences for me. I'm just off having my trip, man, and you don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, okay. So the foundation of what we're saying here is if it isn't a soul plan, and if it wasn't the reason for your coming here, which getting stoned is not, no matter how many times you smoke marijuana, you're not going to be co-creating with God. And you can't say, well, when I smoke marijuana, I'm really more spiritual because I get out and do stuff. But what is the stuff you do? It's material outcome stuff. Right? Because the co-serve, you have to be highly conscious, and the drug lowers consciousness. Oh, it may slightly increase certain sensual awareness. Yeah, it does. That means physical body, sensual is physical body. Awareness, but it does so at great cost in consciousness. It's no great trade-off, believe me. It's a significant destructive factor to consciousness. And that's not a good thing. It interferes. And it interferes with some really important elements of sense. While it may heighten some senses, it distorts and diminishes others. You're robbing Peter, literally, to increase Paul. All right, so that's practically not a good thing to be dealing with. If you're into that, you need to stop it, because you will be dealing with it again in your next physical life. And in the astral world, there'll be effects from it as well. Not on a physical level, but on an emotional one. All right, so what are the other practical considerations? Well, let's talk about getting back to what I started with in the show about intimate relationships. I told you I'd try to finish, or at least by the end of the show, get to this. If you're involved in an intimate relationship, you need to be co-creating with your partner, not just creating with people you know, and they're creating with people they know. That's not the concept. Intimacy of that level requires co-creation together. I know people say something different than this, that I've met many of, who claim, well, she does her thing, I do my thing, or he does his thing, and I do my thing. That, yeah, those things that they're doing are material things. They're not. That's the reason they don't notice that they really are separative and destructive to their relationship. But if they're doing spiritual things, they need to do the spiritual things together, because the foundation of an intimate relationship between souls is spiritual. And the soul's plan is that you learn how to live as a soul while you're physically alive. So you're here to learn to be spiritual together, both in dealing with every part of spiritual life, from conflicts to the joy and to the solutions and even elements of recreation. All of those things come together, but they come together as a unit and not one going off separately doing their thing with their friends and maybe other friends and nobody and maybe the twain should meet and therefore that's how they get along together. Well, that's crazy. And just call each other kind of distant friends and find somebody else to be intimate with, because you're not really leading a soul-level intimate life. You're leading a personality-level, semi-intimate life. And that isn't going to work. It doesn't provide for the development of being a soul here. If you're not going to be a soul with the most intimate person in your life, how are you going to be a soul with everyone else? Let me repeat that. If you think you can be separative with your most intimate, quote-unquote, partner, your marriage partner, or whoever you call them to be your most intimate partner, if you think you can be separate with them but be on a soul level of co-creation spiritually with who knows how many other people, you're in illusion. Not going to happen, isn't happening, and you don't know it. In illusion. Now, as I said at the beginning of the show, if you're in a relationship where it isn't working out, leave. Best thing for you and them, leave. Don't leave clandestinely. Leave openly, honestly. Hey, this isn't working out. Go live your life. Hopefully you'll become more spiritual. I'm going to live my life with the more spiritual, and I'm going to find somebody to do that with who I can do it together with. That's how you live your life, if you're on that level. And don't try to make intimate relationships if they're not spiritual, because they can't be. And they will interfere and destroy your chance of having a spiritual life, because so much energy and so much connection is exchanged between people at that level. Especially when there's a sexual context to it. Sex is the most involved energy transfer between two humans. When sex is there, you have to be extremely careful to make sure that the intimacy is well balanced and that it doesn't cause any harm to the other person and that it results in the kind of spiritual outcome you're looking for. It's difficult. But it has to be one of the requirements when you put it into intimacy, and it should be part of intimacy. Make sure that you're doing these things, because I'm telling you, people make the greatest mistakes in the most awful ways with the people most intimate to them. Get over that, and you'll solve a lot of your problems for future karmic issues. Remember, the soul's plans are for you to have a successful physical life. Success is measured in being a soul while you're here and co-creating with your creator and doing so with other souls that you're involved with and that you know and you can call truly souls. I hope this show has made a difference in your life, and we are definitely running out of time. So I hope this has been somewhat insightful. I know that I've said a lot of controversial things. Email me. Until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.